I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
And I'm Frody.
Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back with another roundtable. And as usual, we like to begin by thanking our donors. So we are trying to raise $100,000 this year, and we are at $83,998.71. I want to thank Spencer for $210, Randy for $20, Rick for $100, Wayne's friend for $20.02, Andrew for $35, BK for $50, Rick for $10, DS for $12, CR for $20, RD for 20 Canadian bucks, which is $15.26 American dollars, at least at the time I jotted that down, AO for $25, MM for 10, RD for another 20 Canadian bucks, AL for 35, Roger for 11, MM again for 10, Roger again for $17.77, Anon for 100, ND for 100, BM for 40, and DS again for 10. And finally, Ben gave $500, which is most generous. Now, the reason why we are adding new donations to the total, even though we have been deplatformed by our credit card processors, is because we do have a P.O. box. And so these were all things that were sent recently into our P.O. box. We are still unable to take credit card donations, but we hope to have rectified that very soon. And if you want to donate, you can donate by mail, or you can donate by cryptocurrency, or you can get in touch with me and we can figure out something. But we really would like your support. It's really crucial because very large numbers of people simply won't donate unless they can do it with the convenience of a credit card. And when we lose that, we lose a lot of people. There's just no way around it. Apparently, some people would prefer to buy stuff on eBay rather than donate to us because, well, it's more convenient to buy stuff on eBay with their card or with PayPal. This is why they go after credit card processing. They go after it because they know it hurts us, and it does hurt. So what's going to have to happen in the future if we can't get reliable card processing is we're going to have to change our mode of support. We are no longer going to be able to keep Countercurrents afloat by selling lots of books and taking small donations from large numbers of people. We're simply not going to be able to do that. And so we're going to have to cultivate a smaller circle of higher dollar patrons, basically. And that's the direction I'm working on. And that's emerging. That is developing at this point. So I am very, very confident that Countercurrents is going to be around for a long time to come. Our mode of raising funds is going to change to adapt to the deplatforming attacks that we're facing. 2019 has been the year of deplatforming for us. The biggest blow came in February when Amazon took down our 17 most profitable titles, basically. They took down 17 titles, and Amazon accounts for more than 70% of the global book market. So that was a blow. We've lost 4 credit card processors this year. Every time we lose a processor, we go back to square one trying to build up new donations. We lose our monthly donors, who are a very important source of funds and stability in fundraising for us. We can plan when we have a certain number of people making monthly pledges. So things are hard, but not impossible. We are finding ways of adapting to this. We are going to change our mode of support so that we're less vulnerable to deplatforming, and we're looking for other alternatives currently. Anyway, again, I want to thank these donors who have helped out. I want to thank you if you're considering helping out. Please get in touch with me. There are ways that we can do this. And I want to thank the people who are helping us find alternatives. There have been a number of friends and well-wishers, basically, who've helped us out with leads on alternatives. So thank you all. And with that, I want to go to our roundtable, we have four questions that we're going to discuss. And I want to begin with a couple of questions that I got today, and then we're going to go back and look at a couple older questions that have been proposed to us. So the first question is very, very brief and to the point. Is white nationalism an inherently toxic brand now that it is associated with bad people and bad optics and bad ideas? So as the author of a book called The White Nationalist Manifesto, I might be biased in favor of that brand and want to maintain that brand. And so, of course, my view is that it's not inherently toxic. But John Frody, do you want to give your thoughts on this before I chime in?
Well, whatever terms that we come up with, eventually they're going to become associated with those things. Like I remember about 7 or 8 years ago when the term identitarian started to become popular in our circles. And a lot of people still use that today. And I think that they saw it as a useful alternative to the existing terms that were out there to describe what we're about. I mean, I know it goes back even further in France, but I at least I noticed it coming into use in English about 7 or 8 years ago. And yes, for a while that is free of any connotations, but as soon as the mainstream, the people who hate us, pick up on the fact that we're using that, they will start doing everything they can to associate these bad things with it. So, you know, you can keep changing the terms, but it's not, you're not going to ever get away from this problem, I would say.
You're not going to get away from the problem, and by constantly changing the terms, you communicate that there's something, I don't know, unserious, kind of shifty about you, maybe a little bit naive, that you think that you can come up with a killer brand, you know, a silver bullet that's finally going to be immune from being smeared in this way, which is a very naive idea. And my view is that we should not respond to the attempts to smear us by the enemy by changing what we call ourselves. Because as soon as we do that, they're just going to, you know, blacken the next term that we use. And they can do that. They can do that to us because they control the media and the educational system, etc., and we don't. So I just don't think there's any point in doing it. It just seems sort of naive to me to think that if we just make a terminological change, then suddenly our enemies are going to lighten up on us and make things a little easier. Frody, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I agree with what you've said. There is a naivety among some people that if we try to placate our enemies or if we try to be diplomatic or meet them halfway, they'll do the same thing. The thing is that they will, like you said, they will try to tarnish every term that we use to describe ourselves. There is a parallel. The term gypsy, at least in Sweden, which is the country that I'm most familiar with, the term gypsy became sort of inappropriate.
It's this way in the English-speaking world.
Yeah, too. And so for a while you were supposed to call them Roma, or Roma in Swedish. But the thing is that that also, I don't know, by sheer coincidence maybe, that name also became tainted. And so people came up with other substitutes like EU migrants, you know, to call the gypsies EU migrants. Because, well, the thing is that, well, in that case, it is probably a lot of things to do with gypsies that people don't want to be associated with, and that's why it gets a negative connotation. And when it comes to things to do with nationalism and white nationalism, it gets a negative connotation because we get negative coverage in the mass media. So people, outsiders, people who are not a part of white nationalism, they get a negative view of it. But playing along with that and adapting and sort of always just responding, being a reactionary, just reacting to what your opponent does all the time, is not a winning strategy. You have to pick your term. You have to pick a term that you feel describes what you believe and represent, and then you have to stick by it.
You have to stick by it. And
because otherwise it just displays weakness and a sort of naive perception of how the world works. That's not how it works. They're going to attack you anyway.
They're going to attack you anyway. There's not going to be a silver bullet brand that's going to be Teflon coated and immune to being blackened by dishonest people in politics and the media. So, yeah, reacting to it and going along with it really grants them power.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we don't have the power to shut their dirty, lying mouths. We don't have the power to stop them from smearing us. But we do have the power to not agree with them and to not go along with them. One of the classic sort of rookie moves, and really one of the most self-defeating things that people do on the right all the time, is they accept the enemy's moral framework. They accept the framework of the enemy, and they try and win within rules that are designed to destroy them by adopting premises that will destroy them. The whole conservative right fails over and over and over again because they will not challenge the enemy's moral frame of reference. They're primarily their moral frame of reference. Right now, the establishment is trying to argue that white nationalism is an intrinsically violent and evil idea that needs to be suppressed. Now, white nationalism is box office poison, basically, at YouTube and Facebook and so forth. And I know why they're doing that, because they're our enemies and they're trying to ruin us. Fine. What I don't understand is when people in our own circles basically give a signal boost to the enemy's attempts to blacken what we do as inherently evil. Because that's going along with the enemy's frame of reference. That is boosting the enemy's message rather than interfering with it, rather than pushing back against it, rather than canceling it. And that's how we lose. Now, there are plenty of things that I don't like about the movement. And I've always been extremely clear about the things that I don't like and the people that I think are toxic. But that doesn't mean, therefore, that we should basically accept the enemy's attempt to brand what we say as intrinsically evil. No. So I don't like a lot of white nationalism 1.0 stuff. I don't like bad people, bad optics, and bad ideas. I fight for better people, better optics, and better ideas. And I want to separate the bad stuff from the core idea of white nationalism, which is basically white self-determination, freeing our people from a system that's out to destroy us. That's an inherently good and noble idea. And I understand why our enemies want to treat that as an inherently toxic term, but I don't understand why people who are ostensibly on our side want to do the enemy's work by accepting their job of blackjacketing us and defaming us and then trying to adapt to that. I don't understand that. I think that's a mistake. So basically, that's my view on this.
This has a parallel in another part of discourse in nationalism and so on. And that is, that has to do with our classic, good old friend, the JQ, Jewish influence.
Right.
Now, I like to have a balanced discussion about Jewish influence in society because it's relevant.
Right.
But I want to emphasize that I want to have a balanced discussion because I want to avoid the crazy people who want to have an unbalanced discussion about it.
Right.
But then again, there are some people who think that it's a very effective strategy to be sort of servile to Jews and to sort of just go out of their way to show how submissive they are and how
friends
they
never, of the Jewish people.
Yeah, I mean, they really go out of their way to show that. And the thing is, it's never reciprocated.
No, it's never reciprocated.
And it just shows weakness. And Jews will not respect that behavior.
Jews don't respect it, and our own people don't respect it. No. And so what you do is you accomplish little to nothing, and you, at the same time, little to nothing positive for the movement. And in fact, you degrade yourself in the eyes of perceptive people. Yeah. And I always thought that that was just a bad idea.
So, it is. Yeah. And the thing is that, I mean, it is not exactly the same thing, but it is a part of, it comes from the same mindset. It is a result of the same mindset. And basically, it's a result of being, how should we put this, not being the cause of actions, but being the reaction to actions.
Right.
Is that what we need to do, we need to be clear about what we want, what we want to do, and we need to just represent that and never back down from it. That's when we get respect from people. And this is parallel to what Jim Goad calls the Passover syndrome.
Right.
Basically referring to the Old Testament when the Jews, you know, painted blood on the doors to, yes, so that the angel of death could see which houses to pass by and just kill the bad people.
Right.
And this is, you know, trying to signal that, oh, I'm not as bad as those
people
over there.
I'm not one of those bad guys.
I'm not one of those people. And I've always really hated that attitude because it just signals weakness. It never works. It never works. It never, I mean, you know, sort of apologizing for what you are and what you represent never works.
Right.
It just signals weakness and it doesn't help you. It's only harmful and it's silly. So, yeah, I mean, it is a problem when people do it for the wrong reasons. I mean, some people might not be white nationalists. I don't know. But the question was, is the label tainted? Or is it not useful?
I think it's honest.
It describes what I stand for, and I'm going to stand by that term because I think it's truthful.
I think that it would be a terrible sign to have adopted a position that nobody wants to smear. Nobody wants to smear it because nobody cares about it. Nobody fears it. Right. I'd also think it would be a terrible situation to have adopted a label or a brand that is so unattractive to people that even bad people with bad optics don't show up eventually. Right. Frankly, you know, we would like people to repair to our brand, our flag, whatever. And that means eventually all of our people. I do think that a movement has to be somewhat elitist in who leads, who is put forward, etc. But at the same time, we do represent the interests of all of our people.
Although we've seen, even with the use of the word populism, which even the civic nationalists embrace, just this week I saw articles, you know, basically equating it with National Socialism. I mean, you know,
well, that's what they'll do.
That
yeah.
That hasn't helped.
Yeah.
I mean, that's about the most innocuous term I can think of.
Exactly. Come up yes. With. Yes.
If you're not over the target, you're not going to get any flack. Is basically the idea. The attempts to smear us are a sign that we're over the target. And yeah, there has been a problem in the movement in bringing in people and especially promoting them publicly when they are bad people. I mean, people of grossly deficient character, people who make terrible lapses in judgment, people who look bad, people who have dumb takes and stuff like that. There's no question that's a problem. And those are own goals. Those are our own problems. These are the things that we've done to ourselves. You know, there are bad people who get involved. There are dumb people. There are people who get involved for the wrong reasons. We have to deal with that internally. But even if we deal with that and we're as squeaky clean as possible, we're as wholesome as a Mormon picnic, there's still going to be attacking us.
Of course.
Yeah. We and there's a very dumb meme that we have to dispute, which is the idea that a lot of people have, which is There's no point in trying to behave in a politic manner or be wholesome or whatever, because they'll just attack you anyway.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
that's going the opposite direction.
Yeah, that's basically just an excuse to, you know, show up in your bathrobe. Just be as crappy as you want to be, because after all, people will attack you anyway. Well, the point is that you don't want to give the enemy things to attack you over, and you want to represent our cause as well as possible, and you want the cause to be filled with people who are trying to be the best they can be, not making excuses for being lacking in some category. But once we eliminate the faults that are on our side, we're still going to be attacked. We're never going to be totally covered with Teflon, put it that way. And therefore, we shouldn't think that we will render ourselves bulletproof and attack proof from the enemy by just being good little boys, etc., or by accepting their moral framework, or by giving a signal boost to their attempts to smear us and things like that. That's not how we win. That's how we lose.
I mean, I'm not a conservative, but some people have thought that, you know, calling themselves conservatives instead, well, that's harmless. Well, that doesn't help either.
Well,
because the left doesn't like conservatives either. They're going to attack you.
Or Gavin McInnes's, what was it, Western chauvinism?
Yeah, Western chauvinism. And although he tried to signal with all kinds of black people in his thing, they still call him a Nazi. They still want him banned.
Yeah.
So it doesn't work. It's better that you internally have your frame of reference rather than looking to your enemies for permission.
Right.
I think that's the basic fault. That's the basic mistake that these people are making, that they look to the other side, to the people who actually want to harm them. They look to them for you know, the moral guidance and for guidance on correct course of action and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a huge mistake. You have to act and talk in a way that resonates with yourself, you know, not what you think that the enemy, that will not upset the enemy or anything.
Mm-hmm. This brings me to another question that was raised in a group that I was chatting in by a friend who said, there's something up in the movement. There are a lot of people who seem to be either doing one of two things. They're affirming some kind of ultra right-wing religious perspective and trying to sort of slink out of the room of politics and just saying, I'm a trad Catholic. Or they're trying to sidle up closer to the political mainstream. And he was just wondering, what's up with that? What's going on there? And I think that's a good question to debate. Over the years, I've seen a lot of people do stuff like this. And I don't think it's because they've had a fundamental shift in their ideas. Now, some people might just have become Catholic. They might have had a conversion or something like that. Some people might have decided after all this immersion in racial nationalist politics that they really are just a kind of conservative or a libertarian, that they're going back to some kind of universalist ideology. There may be sincere people doing this, and I don't want to discount that possibility, although I think that a vanishing percentage of these people are actually sincere. I think there's a kind of Stockholm syndrome thing going on here. I think a lot of people are oppressed by the enmity that's directed towards people in our movement. They feel frustrated by the lack of progress, the deplatforming, et cetera, and they basically want a blue pill. They want to be plugged back into the power plant, basically. They want to take the blue pill and just have a quote-unquote normal life, meaning that they're well integrated into a system that's out to completely exterminate them and all the things that they value. I think that's contemptible. because it's just evading reality on a fundamental and deep level. But for instance, when you go from being a racial nationalist to signaling that you've embraced some kind of universalist ideology, you're basically saying to your enemies, don't attack me. I'm a sucker now. I'm not going to take my own side anymore. I'm not going to oppose you. I'm just a sucker who believes in one world and one human race and Jesus is magic, or, you know, the market's invisible hand is magic, or whatever universalistic ideology they're embracing. Because if you're a universalist, that means that you can be played as a sucker, right? Because the way that the parasite tribes who infest our society work is they pretend to be universalists, and they demand that you're fair to them and recognize them as a human being with inalienable human rights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We're all just human beings here, and they demand that you be fair to them on universalist standards. And when you are, oftentimes they benefit from that. But secretly, they practice nepotism for their own tribe whenever they have some benefit they can pass out. So you apply for a job in their business, and they're going to pretend, my cousin Abdul or Avi or whatever is just the best guy for the job. Just the best guy, you know. It's meritocracy, Goy, right? They'll pretend that. And you, because you have blinded yourself or never awoken to begin with to the role of nepotism and tribalism, can't see that anymore. You become colorblind. Basically, any kind of universalist ethos and ideology is just a form of self-imposed blindness to the way the world really works. And in the world that we live in today, whites are losing our homelands, our culture, and our future as peoples and as a race. And there are a lot of people who are just so demoralized in the movement, and they just want to be left alone, right? So they will pretend that they've had this conversion, and they think that they can get what they want without being nationalists anymore. They think they can get what they want by somehow affirming a universalistic set of principles that will just so happen to lead to what they want. But it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way because we live in a world where tribes are in conflict with one another and where you've got to take your own side.
Well, this relates to the essay that we published yesterday by Nicholas Giovi, where he said, tradition is not socialism. And one of the, he makes many good points in that article, I thought, but one of them was, he says that there is this sort of idea among conservatives, especially boomer cucks, that, you know, what Donald Trump is doing is bad because it's socialist, that he wants to intervene in the economy for the sake of his own people.
Right.
But traditionally, this was always the way things worked. This idea that, you know, there's supposed to be some kind of a universalism is very recent. It's not traditional in Western or any other culture.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's very common for, I've seen this happen several times, that some people get involved with Christianity for social reasons or mm-hmm. for, shall we say, conservative reasons or sort of everyday convenience, because maybe they have little kids and they don't want their kids to grow up with the absolute worst parts of imposed sexual degeneracy in daycare centers or schools and, you know, all the usual stuff that you have to encounter in the public school system. So maybe they go into Christianity to get their kids into a Christian school that maybe has some more controversial conservative values, that teaches more conservative values, and that works in a more normal way. But then when they get into it, it becomes a form of escapism to them.
Yeah.
So they just get deeper and deeper and deeper into it, and where it started out as a tool to shield them from the worst parts of the modern world, it becomes a goal in itself. It becomes an intrinsic value for them, and then it eclipses what they started out as valuing, which is their people and their tribe and so yes. on.
Right.
And then they just become universalists. And that is more acceptable. So it becomes a very comfortable, soothing thing for them. And it becomes a very seductive form of escapism. And I think that happens to many people. And I think that people, sure, there are some people who are basically wired as, you know, saints. They will see what's right or wrong and they will go for it. And they will live their lives in accordance with what they think is wrong, no matter what happens to them and so on. But I think that for 99.99999% of all humanity, they will only really take action against something when, you know, just remaining quiet and silent and not doing anything becomes more painful for them than actually doing something. When things become so bad that they basically feel they have nothing to lose from actually standing up against this tyranny. Before that happens, I think they will try, many people, and not everyone, because there are many people who are you know, very good and solid people, but many people will try to find excuses for escapism and will try to find proxies and substitutes where they can talk about, well, we fight for Western values, not for, you know, a specific people or, you know, mm-hmm. or ethnic interests or anything like that. They will
or
try.
Even worse, that people say, oh, we fight for freedom.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, the basic human sort of gut feeling motive for it all is, of course, their tribal instinct. They know that they are being attacked as a group, as a people, but they try to react in a way that you know will not put them in a, that will not tarnish their reputation, and that which will allow them to live a normal life, as normal as possible in the modern world, and
right.
that becomes more and more difficult.
I got another question today, and it's quite topical. Earlier this week, Margot Metroland reviewed Andrew Marantz's book, Antisocial. And the question is, Andrew Marantz's book, Antisocial, tells the story of Samantha, who got involved in Identity Europa and the alt-right, rose through the ranks, became disaffected, and then left the movement and talked to the enemy. In view of Samantha and other doxings by ex-scene groupies like Katie McHugh, should the movement simply ban women?
Well, that it's kind of erroneous to assume that the only problematic people we have in our circles are women. I mean,
yeah.
there have
yeah.
been plenty of men who have caused us trouble as well.
There are male doxers, definitely male doxers. I do think that we have to raise some questions here about agency and responsibility and so forth. This Samantha case, first of all, I know people who knew her, so she's a real person. The basic story is legit. I think, you know, from what she says in the Marantz book, she got involved in the racialist scene through her boyfriend, but she got involved in Identity Europa first, I believe, and then got him into it. That she got rose through the ranks very quickly because she was responsible and would actually perform things. She separated from her boyfriend. Then a guy came to live with her who came on very strong and tried to have a relationship, but it sort of fizzled. And he insisted, though, on publicly pretending that they were a couple. And he was very ambitious within the group, etc. The profile of the ambitious up-and-coming leader and the parasitic phony basically screams Eli Mosley to me. This was Eli Mosley's girlfriend. And the situation was is that she had, you know, some sort of falling out with him, some sorts of fallings out with other people in the movement. I think she was sleeping around with a few people. And for whatever reason, it became toxic and she left. And then she ended up talking to Marantz. Um, Does this mean that we shouldn't have women involved in the movement? Well, no, I don't think so. I think, though, that the thing that the doxing females have in common, there are three cases of this. One is a woman who hasn't been named yet. The other is Katie McHugh. The other is a Samantha girl. The woman who hasn't been named is one of the people who doxed this guy who goes by the name of Coach Finstock. And the thing that's truly horrible about a lot of these doxings is the people who have been doxed were nothing but nice to these women, gave them all kinds of help and everything like that. But the reason why they started doxing people was that they encountered people who were extremely toxic. And in lashing out against these extremely toxic people, they, in a truly evil way, it's true evil. It's true malice. It's the kind of evil that makes you wish there were a hell with eternal fires, because it's just such reckless malice. They actually harmed perfectly decent people who did nothing but help them. And I think that's really monstrous and unforgivable. But the basic point that I want to say is this, is that I think these women were defective women to begin with. They're not just any woman. I think they're defective women who were drawn into a movement that has a strongly misogynist vibe to it, and then drawn from the nice guys to the worst kind of exploiters. And then the whole thing blew up. And then they go and they dox a lot of people, including people who are perfectly nice to them. And it's like my view is that, you know, let's not just talk about banning women, because that's too broad a brush, and it doesn't take any responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of these misogynists claim that women have no agency, but somehow they want to put all the blame on them. If women have no agency, then they get no blame. Right. They're only as bad as the men around them. And the men around them, unfortunately, were some pretty class A assholes. Right. So if we're going to have a reform, I think we should, first of all, let's dispel the extremely misogynistic atmosphere that clings to the movement, because that attracts the wrong kind of women and actually repels decent ones. And let's actually root out the true Chad misogynist assholes that, you know, that these women had toxic relationships with. At the very least, we shouldn't put them in positions of responsibility. That I think is definitely key. So I just think that the attempt to go from the Katie McHugh case or the Samantha case to the conclusion that we just need to get rid of all women, yeah, it's just really kind of dumb. It's very crude. It's very crude. And let's be perfectly honest. I've been opposed on record for a long time to the idea that there's something wrong with the movement if there's not gender parity. I think that's a kooky idea. By the same token, though, we're not going to be a successful movement if we're not the kind of movement that attracts sensible women.
And who comprise 52% of our people.
Yeah, exactly. we're not going to be we're not going to be a force to reckon with if we don't attract decent, normal women. We're not attracting the decent, normal women in some cases. I mean, these used up, embittered movement groupies were damaged goods to begin with, as far as I'm concerned. They entered a scene that was quite hostile to them, and they moved directly to the worst, most toxic people to take up with. You know, and so to say that this is just the weaker sex, you know, is too broad brush. And again, if women have no agency, they have no responsibility. All the responsibility for this goes to the men, and specifically the men they were sleeping with. But the idea that we should ban women basically absolves the men. Nice. So you just can't do that. I do think that we have to be really careful. I mean, we do have to think about this, though. Should we have groups that are, you know, sex segregated? Sure. If people want that, that's good. Should groups not want to have single women as opposed to married women? I think that's a legitimate thing. When you have single women in groups that are overwhelmingly male, they can be a disruptive force. There's no question about it. People start, it's like women in the military. I think we believe that it's perfectly legitimate to say that there should be no women in combat or women in the military because it lowers effectiveness. And it might do that the same way with movement groups. There might be some groups that are better off without them. The other thing is, though, is that why not just try and adopt a really strong professional ethical code that if you're in the movement, you know, it's frowned upon to fraternize.
Mm. You know? Yeah, I mean, if you look at the successful revolutionary movements of the last century, you know, both communist and on the right as well, they were always very effective at mobilizing women.
Yeah.
But they also kept them quite, well, you still even see it in communist China today. They mm-hmm. have these groups, but they're generally sex segregated. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not saying, like you said, that this should be the rule, but
but in certainly context, some groups should. And since radical politics is more like combat than anything else, you would think that it maybe should be more modeled that way. But if you have organizations, I mean, you go to a conference like the American Renaissance Conference. A conference isn't an organization. It's an event. But maybe there should be something of an understood ethos that, look, this is not a place for picking up people. We're trying to be serious here. You can't inject these personal things in here. It just makes for too explosive a brew. And the other thing is that I really do think that we have to be very, very careful about guys who are playing the field in the movement with movement groupies, because we've got a history of these people, a well-established history within this rule, this year, of this exploding in really bad and damaging ways. And the story of Samantha is not finished. You know, in Marantz's book, she's talking about, he talks about her sharing audio recordings and stuff.
So those are out there somewhere.
They're out there somewhere. Yeah, they're out there somewhere. It's there's just no end to the negative consequences of just a couple of these embittered groupies going to the press. We're going to be seeing consequences of this for years to come, probably. Well, and we just have to be really careful about that. If somebody has a reputation for playing the scene with movement groupies and using and disposing of them, you just got to take the guy aside and say, dude, you're playing with fire, and it can harm all of us. It can really harm all of us. And let's be very, very clear. If we stand for Western civilization, we stand for monogamy. We don't stand for polygamy. We don't stand for adultery. We don't stand for primate pickup politics and that kind of shit. You know, I do think that we have to take some people aside and just say that we've had enough experience of this blowing up in the movement's face, and it's not good for all of us.
Well, I think another lesson I would take from this is just the fact that, and this isn't just limited to women, but you have to be careful when people come in and they're new. And I mean, across the board as a movement, we are severely understaffed, and there's very few people willing to take up the mantle to become activists or organizers or whatever. So mm-hmm. it's very easy. Somebody like this woman comes into the movement, and very quickly she's given a lot of responsibility. But very often, especially when you're dealing with very young people like this woman was, you know, their ideas aren't fully formed yet, and you don't know where they're going to end up. So I think you have to be a little bit more cautious with people when they first come in, especially when they're young, just to think like, okay, is this person still going to be standing for the same things, you know, 5 or 10 years from now, is something going to happen and derail them, and then they end up turning against us and doing a lot of damage.
Yeah.
I think that's something that needs to be, because I've seen this happen a number of times now.
I might be the, I don't know if I'm the odd man out, but there's something about the whole, I don't know, the aura of this question that makes me uncomfortable. Because the question was, should we ban women from the movement? Now, I never wanted to be a part of a movement. I don't really see myself as a part of a movement. I see a problem out there in the world. There's a very severe problem, which is that we're being invaded and swamped and attacked, basically genocided. We need to address that problem, and we need to put ideas out there. But there is a mentality which is sort of weird, sectarian, and self-marginalizing, self-ghettoizing, which is sort of, you see yourself as part of a movement that is sort of tightly knit, and should we ban women from this movement?
Well, we don't have the power to ban anybody.
It sort of just radiates this freakish weirdness. The question is weird itself.
It's a weird question.
I don't want to be a part of a movement, and the whole question, should we ban women, is just completely insane.
Well, yeah.
It's a rhetorical question in a way. I'm not saying anything against the person asking the question itself, but there is something about that mentality which is just toxic, which is something that I never want anything to do with. I never want people have anything to do with people with that mentality. I don't want anything to do with the sectarian weird movement thing. I don't want to be a part of this ghettoizing sort of mentality,
yeah,
and the sort of banning women, the sort of MGTOW weirdo bullshit. I'm just sick of it.
Well, yeah, the idea of banning women from the movement, if you try and think what that means, it boils down to, I think we should ban women from the internet. Well, I'm sorry, that's not possible. It's not possible when you have a movement that consists of a network of online people for the most part, and a few little IRL groups, many of which don't have any memberships, much less any standards of membership. How do you ban women? I guess you can't let women come to the Scansa Forum. How you ban women.
It's weird. I don't see that thing. And people aren't that sort of fanatically ideological. They just want to be a part of something. And I think that's weird. And also a problem that's connected to the movement mentality and the weirdness of that is that when a thing like this happens, it's somehow just because a person in America did something and it gets revealed in this book or whatever, other people in some other country who have nothing to do with him have to some sort of be responsible for that, or the sort of, it has nothing to do with me. It has nothing to, it's like, I'm not a part of a movement. I don't care what other people do. I don't care who they hang out with, what they do, what they write, because I take responsibility for what I do. And I just think it's weird. And I think that mentality and the sort of energy that radiates is exactly what attracts weird people. Because they want to be a part of that sectarian, self-marginalizing, self-ghettoizing thing, because they feel like outsiders. And as outsiders, they can...
they can finally be insiders in something.
Yeah, it's like a joke in the South Park that to be a nonconformist, you just have to be like all the other nonconformists.
Yeah.
You know, and it's you know, they can feel some sort of a sense of fraternity or something with the other weirdos, and that's why they want to be a part of that.
The International Fraternity of Nonconformists.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, it's like clubs. I think the reason that someone might, how should I put this? That someone finds him or herself motivated to ask that question is worrying in itself.
Yeah, well, I think whether the person who raised that question is raising it himself or just raising a question that he's heard other people raise.
Yeah, like I said, I'm not saying this personally against him or her, but it's
but the idea is the memes are floating around, and alarming.
And that's alarming.
There's a world picture here
that's
not real. It's not connected with reality. We are not some kind of Bolshevik organization,
exactly,
top down, yeah, with barriers to entry and stuff like that. That's not how the movement as a whole works. It's, yeah, it's a decentralized, largely virtual online thing,
yeah,
where there are lots of people who come and go under various names, et cetera, et cetera. And honestly, you don't know much about the person at the other end. I don't know anything about the person who raised this question.
And basically, it's
a part of... It could have been written by a woman, for God's sake.
Exactly, yeah.
You know,
No.
How do we protect ourselves against that?
That's the point. The point is that this is connected to the same mentality that motivates conspiracy theories. It's basically that the whole world is conspiring against us, and only people within this movement are safe people to interact with, and who shall we let into this tightly knit little weird group? No, thank you. I don't want to be a part of that.
So you had a question that you had from a comment thread.
Yeah, there was a comment to something. There was a comment to my introduction for the Skanza Forum in Copenhagen. Someone wrote this comment, and it's a classic, it's an old question. It's been answered before, I think, but since I get the impression that the person who wrote it was sincere, we might as well answer it. The question goes thusly: I struggle to understand the quote-unquote whiteness identity outside of a couple of hundred years of Americanism, since it is a relatively new idea formed around the predominantly European ethnic mix that came to existence in America during the initial stages of globalism. For the sake of comparison, I very much doubt that Hitler's Germany thought of themselves as quote-unquote white people. They were German, and God love you if you were not. So in this discussion of whiteness, populism, and nationalism, are you all discussing populism as a euphemism for blah, blah, blah? Well, let's just, this is a longer thing, but with regard to whiteness, white nationalism or white identity, is it relevant outside of the American context, or is it like an American thing? It's definitely relevant outside of the American context. It doesn't matter if it sort of first became a household concept in America. That doesn't matter, because right now all white people are banned from being nationalists, and only white people are being banned from being nationalists, and it doesn't matter where they live. So to me, white nationalism means a very simple thing, is that white people, no matter where they live, also have a right to be nationalists. Swedes have a right to be nationalists, ethnic nationalists in Sweden, not state civic nationalists, ethnic nationalists. White people have a right to be nationalists as white people. In America, that nationalism as whiteness is probably more relevant as a concept in itself, because, you know, white American or European American, as opposed to, you know, black American.
I would just say that that Americans simply are white people.
Yeah.
I want to just reject the idea that there's a civic definition of Americans. I'm perfectly happy to talk about Asian Americans or African Americans.
Right.
But
right.
Americans, without the hyphenated construct, are just white people, in my view.
But I just want to emphasize one last thing, and that is that white nationalism, I know very many white nationalists, but I don't know one single white nationalist who believes that white nationalism means that you are only allowed to be a nationalist as a white person and nothing more. That is,
right,
that you have to give up all more sort of narrow identities or local identities. That if you're a white nationalist, you have to give up your French or German identity or English identity. No one believes that. It's just that as white people, no matter where we live, we are attacked as white people. All other peoples are allowed to be nationalists. We are not, and therefore our destinies are connected. The destiny of people in Europe and European countries, that is connected to what happens to people in America, because we're under attack. The world is globalized now. I mean, whether we like it or not, things happen and affect each other. So what happens to white people in America, that affects me. And it's in my interest to look out for their interest as well. And that's the only thing that white nationalism means to me, that white people have a right to be nationalists and a duty to be nationalists.
And our enemies have no doubt about who we are.
No,
there's never a problem. There's never a problem. If you, as soon as you talk about how bad white people are, there's never a problem of definition. Well, who is that? Who is white? But you know, when you're going to talk about white guilt or you know, who's going to pay those reparations to American slave,
descendants
was the word. Yeah. When who's going to pay? Well, the problem of who's white doesn't really seem relevant. So
one pipes up and says, you know, but white is just a social construct.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Yeah, the concept of whiteness is relevant outside the Americas. It's relevant in Europe,
of course.
Even in Hitler's Germany, after the First World War, there were half black children being born in the Rhineland because of Senegalese troops that were being stationed there as part of the French occupation. And the Germans had no difficulty determining that these were not really Germans. And what was the basis on which they concluded that these half-Senegalese children whose mothers spoke German and who were brought up speaking German weren't German? It was race, right? Yes. There's more to being German than being white, but it's necessary to be white to be German. Mm. And everybody understands that. And as civic nationalism is pushed more and more, we have to push back with racial nationalism. Otherwise, if you want to say, I don't want to talk about concepts like race, well, you might not be interested in race, but race is interested in you. If you don't want to talk about race as a component of German identity, what are you going to do with all the quote-unquote new Germans? Yes. Or the new Swedes? Or the new French? Well, they're not that new in France. I mean, France has been integrated with the non-white world and giving citizenship to non-whites for a very long time because they decided, based on this revolutionary ideology, to be basically civic nationalist for a very, very long time. But that doesn't matter to most French people because they know that that's just a fiction. Mm-hmm. You know, the Tahitians aren't really French people, even though Tahiti is a department of France, right? We know the truth about this. And when we articulate why Tahitians really aren't French, it's race. They're not descended from the Franks, or they're not descended from people who intermarried with the Franks and learned the language and so forth. The existence of what we call naturalization is the only sense in which you can talk about how there's a kind of social construct of nationality, right? Nationality just isn't descent. Because, well, people can marry into another nation, right? They have to be compatible on some level, primarily racially, and they have to assimilate the conventional aspects of national identity, like language and so forth, or at least their children do. But what's the underlying assumption when you talk about who can be naturalized and who can't? Well, it's going to be race. You're going to say, well, you know, you can become a German, but Africans are not good fits. Asians are not good fits. When the first act of the American national government was to create an immigration and naturalization law, they addressed this issue and they said the only people who can be naturalized and become part of our body politic in America are free white people.
Of good character.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought, well, that's sensible. And that's not just because they were surrounded by other races and so forth. And the fact is, though, that we live on the surface of a finite globe. And if you go far enough in any direction, you're going to find yourself surrounded by other races, whether you're a German or a Swede or whoever, and you're going to have to think about race as a component of identity. It's not the whole of it, but it's a necessary component of it. and therefore it's legitimate to talk about white nationalism. Another reason why it's legitimate is the simple fact that Europe is being invaded by non-whites, and they don't recognize Poles versus Germans. They're just white people. They're white people, or white bastards, you know, as some of them said recently while attacking a white man or a couple of white men in England. Our differences don't matter to them. And insofar as we're in a struggle for survival, they don't matter to, they shouldn't matter to us either. We can separate and go our own ways after we fight this battle. But we're being targeted not as Germans or French or whatever, but simply as white people. Mm-hmm. And we have to fight back as such. Otherwise, we are in the criminally irresponsible position of a government, say, that is invaded by land and sends its armies to the ocean to fight. Mm-hmm. The enemy picks you, and it picks where it attacks you and how it attacks you. And if you don't respond in kind, then you're a criminally irresponsible idiot. But that's the way that all conservatives are. All conservatives basically look at a race war that's coming, that's been launched against us, and they try and make it about something else, which means they're never really fighting back. You have to go racial eventually.
Yeah, the conservatives, they give up and assume that they've lost before they start fighting, so they never start fighting to begin with. And then they try to behave in a manner so that they won't be punished by the enemy. They try to be good boys or good boys and get a pat on the back.
Right.
And they don't want to fight because that might anger the enemy. Well, so it's just a weird mentality, and it's disgusting.
They're disgusting and weak people.
Yeah, it's an unmanly attitude.
But some conservatives, I think, have a genuine belief. I mean, something I heard many times from conservatives in the U.S. was, and I think this goes back to the civil rights era, this notion that, well, the problem with blacks and other minorities in the U.S. is that, they have to be made basically into good American middle class people, essentially to become white, that if they just have all the same opportunities and they're educated to the same level and they make the same salary as white people, they'll just become like us. Mm-hmm. Because they deny that there's any racial component to behavior, that, you know, being an American is just sort of this generic thing that relies on your material status, which of course is complete nonsense. But I mean, I think there's still a lot of conservatives who think that way, and I think they genuinely believe it. I don't think it's
the answer to that basically they're assimilationists, and you have to say, look, we're not assimilating them. We're not even trying. Multiculturalism.
We shouldn't
assimilate them. Yeah. No. Well, I mean, first of all, yeah, we don't want to. I mean, there's a threefold answer to assimilationism. First, we're not even trying it. So if you think that the success of America depends upon the assimilation of non-white groups, and we're importing more and more non-whites all the time, and we're not even trying to assimilate it, in fact, we've adopted the opposite principle, which is multiculturalism, then you should be opposed to all immigration, especially of non-whites, until such time as we start assimilating these people, right? The second thing is that we don't really want to assimilate these people. We shouldn't want to assimilate them. And the third point I always make is that they're assimilating us.
Yes.
You know, the very idea that we can get along with people who aggressively want to transform America into something resembling the Middle East or Mexico is just folly of the worst kind. And this is so typical of conservatives. They just want to avoid the hard issues. They want to avoid the fact that we're being invaded and destroyed and replaced. And they're conserving nothing because they won't even talk about
They're rationalizing out of fear. They know they're attacked as white people. They know that when they move from a neighborhood, they do so to live among their own tribe.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just
they're selfish people. They want to make a separate peace. They don't want to take responsibility for the body politic. At most, they want to help their family and their careers, and they're just not. They're not the kind of people who can fight for a future for white people anywhere in the world. And until conservatism basically is destroyed as a movement, until the best people leave conservatism or stop supporting it, they're just going to be there to basically waste time and run out the clock, prevent people from organizing to halt white demographic replacement until the enemy thinks it's too late. Right. Of course, it's never going to be really too late, because once we have a banana republic, well, banana republics don't really have democracy anyway. So even if we're a minority in a banana republic, the minorities in banana republics rule quite comfortably.
As they do in our society.
Yeah, yeah. So we just have to become the minority. The point is that there's never a point at which we can just color ourselves lost. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really just a matter of will. And we just have to stop listening to weak people, weak, depressive people who want to say it's impossible to change anything now. It's too late. No, it's not. It wasn't too late in the South under Reconstruction, when whites were an absolute minority in a democracy, and somehow they managed to regain control of their society for better part of a century. It wasn't that too late then. It wasn't too late when Spain was under the heels of Moors for going on 8 centuries, you know. Wasn't too late 800 years after the Moorish invasion. So, you know, for people to say it's too late now, basically you just have to shout them down. Shout them down, shut them up, take them aside, maybe see if they've got some substance to them, some backbone that maybe you can give them a little pep talk. You know, and if they don't, you just shut them out of the conversation completely, because they're of no use. They're the kind of people who in a battle will just scream, it's all lost, we need to surrender. You know, you can't have people like that around. So we've been going at it for an hour, and I think this has been a really good discussion. So I want to thank everybody for tuning in. I want to thank all of our donors again. If you want to donate during this particularly difficult time and we can't take your credit cards, please send me an email at editor@countercurrents.com, editor@countercurrents.com. We can set you up with a way of doing a cryptocurrency donation or a money transfer or whatever. But we really do want your help if you can help out. So thank you very much, and join us again next week for another episode of Countercurrents Radio.